This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening. This is Rockash, your host this week on A People Speak Radio on the BBS network. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen in by phone calling 760-569-7676, then entering the access code 192919 pound when prompted. Or if you have a computer or smartphone, go to bbsradio.com and navigate to station 2 and click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with a call-in question for our guest, toll-free in the United States and Canada, 1-888-429-5421. Tonight we've got a very special guest by the name of Norman Finkelstein. I'm sure a lot of you know who he is, and I'm sure a lot of you might not. He is a voice of reason, a voice of freedom, a voice of equality, and a voice of justice for the Palestinian people. Norman, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Norman, you've been battling, not so much the Israeli occupation, but the treatment of the Palestinians. And can you please fill us in on what your battle has been and what your goals are? Are you for a two-state solution? Are you for a Palestinian state in full, or are you in for a one state of Israel? What is your take on all of that?
Well, I think the first thing about politics is to try to depersonalize it, because politics is not really about what you're for or what I'm for or what, for that matter, anybody's for. Politics is about trying to figure out what's the maximum you can hope to achieve at a particular historical moment, and then trying to organize public opinion in order to achieve that goal. That's, to my understanding, what radical politics is about. And so when I advocate a position, I'm not advocating it because, in my opinion, it's the most desirable or the ideal. It's because I think this is, under the circumstances, the maximum that can be achieved in the way of some principle of justice. And I think the maximum that can be achieved in the current circumstances, the maximum that you can win public opinion over to, the maximum you can hope to galvanize public opinion around, is a full Israeli withdrawal from the territories it occupied in June 1967, the creation of a Palestinian state in the whole of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, and a just resolution of the refugee question, the Palestinian refugee question. Those are basically the terms for resolving the conflict that have been embraced by both a broad spectrum of countries around the world in places like the UN General Assembly, and also by respected legal bodies such as the International Court of Justice and respected human rights organizations such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. So whether you look at public opinion based on where the overwhelming sentiment currently resides, or you look at it in terms of what the most enlightened sectors of public opinion have to say, there seems to be almost a perfect overlap. The most representative institutions in the world today and the most respected institutions in the world today. They support the two-state settlement on the June 67 border and a just resolution of the refugee question. And as to my own personal opinion, as I said at the outset, in politics I consider that an irrelevant issue.
Absolutely. The refugee question is a very, very big question. I guess Israel would be forced to pay restitution to those refugees that are living in Lebanon and for their what their current value of the property is or what their current value of the property was. But either way, these people were just tossed out in the dark and left to be pretty much alone and hungry. So they need, I would say, need to come up with a very, very large sum of restitution in order to justify the amount of land that they took from the people during the occupation in the first place.
Well, under international law, as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have both affirmed, the Palestinian refugees have a right to return to their homes and a right to compensation for losses that have accrued over a half century. That's the right, and I don't think anybody has the right to deny, to gainsay a Palestinian right under international law. On the other hand, I think it's a matter of common sense and common knowledge that the implementation of that right is not easily achieved, not easily accomplished. It raises many practical issues, and it also raises some principled issues. And then the question is, how do you contrive a solution to the refugee question that both respects the right under international law, yet also takes into account the practical difficulties of implementing that right? And I don't presume to have a formula or a blueprint for achieving that reconciliation between the right and the practical exigencies of trying to implement that right. But I think we have to be careful about reducing the refugee question simply to a matter of compensation. I think it's clear that it involves many things more, not the least of which is an acknowledgement by Israel of the crime it committed in the course of the creation of the State of Israel, namely the expulsion of the overwhelming majority, some 80%, of the indigenous population in the area that became the State of Israel.
Right. Well, not only the expulsion, but also the murdering of people and children and, you know, these people.
Most expulsions are carried out in the course of systematic and methodical brutality. A nation doesn't, on its own volition, just pack its bags and disappear.
That's correct. What do you see? I'm going to change focus a little bit. What do you see happening right now? As far as yesterday, Israel attacked a camp, killing three people, and this was a refugee camp.
Well, right now, because of multiple factors, most notably the implosion of the Arab Muslim world, the defeat of Hamas's chief benefactor in Egypt, namely the Muslim Brotherhood, the depoliticization and despondency of the Palestinian population as a whole, and the corruption as well as the thraldom of what's called the Palestinian Authority. Between those factors, there's some hope on the part of the United States that they might be able to ram through a settlement of the conflict on the Israeli terms. The Israeli terms have been pretty clear for the past decade and more. Israel is determined to keep what are called the major settlement blocks, which constitute about 10% of the West Bank. And if they achieve that goal, pretty much nothing remains a Palestinian state, because it will mean that Israel will annex critical land resources in the West Bank, critical water resources in the West Bank. They'll annex East Jerusalem, which is the hub of Palestinian life, under the annexation of the settlement blocks. But the U.S. is hoping that the Palestinians are now in such a weak position that they may be able to ram through the Israeli terms of settlement. And that's basically what's happening now. That's called the peace negotiations.
So basically you're saying it's all on Israel's terms and nothing really gained by the Palestinians.
Yeah, because the Palestinians have no cards to play at the current moment. Economically, they're totally enthralled to the United States. Politically, they can't have any support internationally unless they mobilize the one factor that can turn the tide, and that's the Palestinian people themselves. But the Palestinian Authority dreads the prospect of mobilizing the population, because they know if the Palestinian people do become mobilized, the first thing they'll do is get rid of the current leadership, which are just a band of corrupt collaborators with the United States and Israel.
Well, this is what I'm fearing right now. If anything happens in Syria, I'm fearing that the entire area is going to explode into a ball of fire.
Well, the entire area is already exploded into a ball of fire. And right now, the U.S. and its allies in the region, most notably Saudi Arabia and Israel, are, so to speak, on a roll. The Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, was overthrown, and the Mubarak regime has effectively been restored. Large parts of the Arab world are just fragmenting into fiefdoms of warlords, meaning there's no effective counterweight to the United States. And so the only thing that really remains... Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. The only thing that really remains, the only obstacles to total U.S.-Israeli-Saudi domination of the region, the only obstacles that remain are Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah, the Party of God in Lebanon. I think there are several motives now for Obama to involve himself in the Syrian conflict, and I don't think there is one uniform policy. In part, it's because Obama had made the statement about use of chemical weapons as a red line, and so he's finding it difficult to back down from that policy statement he issued several months ago. Secondly, there are some people in and around the Obama administration who think that the time might now be ripe to, since Egypt is now back in the fold, why not try to knock out Bashar in Syria and put Syria under U.S. control, U.S., Saudi, Israeli control. So there are some people who have some, you can call, ambitious plans. Once, if and when Bashar is knocked out, the next step will be the U.S. will go in to wipe out the Hezbollah, and then that will leave Iran completely isolated and much more amenable to U.S. demands. So there are some people in and around the Bush administration who think this might be an opportunity to knock out Bashar and bring the new regime within the U.S.-Israeli-Saudi sphere of influence. And then there are others also in and around the Obama administration who think the ideal situation is to just let each side bleed the other to death and reduce Syria to a socio-economic nullity. So in the past few months, the Bashar regime has been on the offensive. They controlled 13 of the 14 provincial capitals, and it was clear that even though it was a stalemate, it was a stalemate with the Bashar government having the upper hand. And now there are some people in and around the Obama administration who want to restore the initiative of the so-called opposition. And so their goal is to target the Syrian regime's war-making capacity in order to, as I said, restore the initiative of the opposition and thereby perpetuate a conflict which will result in the end of Syria, as it's been known since the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, you know, this is, in my view, complete lunacy. The military might be there, but the people are not. The people in the regions are not with these globalists and their agendas. So I see, you know, I see revolutions actually going on again in Egypt, even though Mubarak
has... No, there's no possibility of that. These sorts of prognostications have no connection with reality. First of all, in Egypt, one has to accept that even though I deplored the military coup from the day it began on July 2nd, the fact of the matter is, for a variety of reasons, not all of them the result of the Muslim Brotherhood's actions. There's no question that the Muslim Brotherhood was largely isolated in public opinion. There seems to be no real dispute that the army coup was had popular backing, and there is no possibility now or in the foreseeable future that the dynamic, what was called the revolution, the revolutionary dynamic, will be restored in Egypt. Right now, the people are exhausted, they're weary, they're concerned about security, they're concerned about daily life. They have no desire for any further, they actually don't seem to have any desire for any or interest in politics at all anymore. They have rallied around Sisi, and their hatred and loathing of the Brotherhood, again for many reasons, reached a point that large components of the population, can't say with precision, but large components of the population support the bloodbaths and the slaughter of the army, which resulted in the deaths of probably around 2,000 or more unarmed Muslim Brotherhood members and supporters. So the revolution is over in Egypt. It lasted about 2 years. Well, it started January 2011. So it lasted close, actually, 2.5 years. But revolutions have a life, and counter-revolutions also have a life. And the counter-revolution has now prevailed, and that happens in politics.
Well, it's prevailed in the meantime, but I wasn't just speaking about Egypt in general. I was speaking about the entire region where, you know, the people aren't with the governments on this.
There aren't governments. That's the whole point. There aren't governments. Libya no longer exists as an entity. It's now been fragmented into areas controlled by warlords. Iraq is still racked by daily mass deaths, mass killings, inter-ethnic conflict, inter-religious conflict. Syria seems to be as close as one can get to a civil war, but a civil war which is overlaid by international powers, a large number of international powers, including the Saudis, the Americans, the French, the Russians. I'm sure I've left out some, actually. Syria has become a pawn in a chess game. But there's no question that the opposition enjoys large sectors of popular support, and there's no question that the government, Bashar regime, also enjoys large sectors of popular support. But to speak about revolution in those contexts is just, it's a complete disconnect from reality. There are no positive outcomes, possibilities, or futures in Syria. Both the government and the opposition are murderers, torturers, corruption beyond human imagination, both moral and material. It's impossible for any rational person to discern a positive outcome from the situation in Syria. It's a human disaster. It's a catastrophe.
Yeah, well, I see things in a different fashion. I see the people there taking up arms, and not just the people of Syria, but I believe that the Saudi people and the Gulf region in itself might end up overthrowing their royal leaders.
There were at the beginning of the Arab Spring, there was a hope for a domino effect, and there were stirrings in part of Saudi Arabia, the Shia regions of Saudi Arabia. There were stirrings in Bahrain. There was some hope, but the counter-revolution had a lot more historical experience, a lot more resources at its command, and was able to reverse those original gains. And the defeat that was inflicted in Egypt has to be reckoned a major setback. And just as I said, revolution has its eddying effect and its repercussions. So this counter-revolution. And right now, the Arab Spring has been effectively silenced. What will happen 5 or 10 years, I don't know. But I think Egypt is now back to the Mubarak years. That happens. Happens many places. You go back to the beginning of the 20th century. There was a revolution in Russia in 1904, 1905. It was put down in 1906. It lasted about 2 years. And then there was a long hiatus until 1917. Actually, Lenin himself despaired that he would never live to see the socialist revolution in Russia. And basically, it happened because another unpredictable event happened, namely World War One. And so it took a while, and then through a concatenation of events, the natural climax of 1905, namely 1917, happened. But one has to give due acknowledgement to counter-revolutions. There was a revolutionary upsurge in Egypt, just as there was in Russia in 1904 through 6, and it was defeated. That happens. That's politics.
Quick question for you before we go to break. And when we come back, I have some callers on the phone with their questions on the People Speak Radio. Norman, who are the FSA and who is arming them and supplying them and funding them?
Well, it's a mixed bag. There are, I suppose there still remain some elements there which are relatively honest. But as I said, the internal struggle has now been overlaid with the external struggle, with powers, and the main forces. I left out, actually, when I gave the list, I left out a significant regional player, which has also been playing, unfortunately, a nefarious role, namely Turkey. And so the main backers of the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, they include everybody from Saudi Arabia to France, the United States, the United Kingdom, the Turks, and it includes a wide array of forces, including Al-Qaeda and various jihadis. And so now you have the odd spectacle of the United States making common cause with Al-Qaeda.
Great. Let me go to our audience. I have one question for you, and it's a real quick one. John in Pennsylvania wants to know, isn't the real problem here the command and the control, global bureaucracy, and both sides trying to leverage the globalist body? Isn't this in fact, a symptom of the global governance? And yes, I believe you've already stated that. So if you can give me a quick answer on that, we have a minute.
I'm not sure I understand the question. Are the two main parties to the conflict in Syria trying to leverage international support?
No, I believe he was stating that is this part of the one world government, the globalist body, that is
world government. I mean, all these conspiracy theories are completely harebrained. Mm-hmm. You don't need to look into a crystal ball in order to understand what's happening in the world. Obviously, there's machination, and obviously there's plotting, and there's conspiracy. But the broad picture is pretty clear. We have a good sense of who's fighting in this so-called opposition. We have a good sense of who's supporting that opposition. Now we know who are the backers of the Bashar regime. That's not, there's no mystery there. You don't have to conjure up one world government, or whatever else. This is just, I don't know, what is this fixation, this obsession by people with conspiracies, when the basic facts are pretty clear. Now, if you ask me a question, a particular question, like what exactly happened with this claim of the use of chemical weapons, and who was behind it, and who is responsible for it? That's a question.
Well, we'll get right back on that same question when we come back from our break. We are going to break here on the People Speak with our guest Norman Finkelstein and the BBS Radio.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. When I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak. Every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Welcome back to The People Speak on the BBS Radio Network with our guest, Dr. Norman Finkelstein. Norman, how are you? Let's go back to where we left off on who might have done the chemical attack in Syria.
Well, I would say of the range of possible suspects, I would say the least likely to the point of almost certainty that he didn't do it was Bashar, because Bashar Assad, the head of state, for the obvious reason that number one, even though it was stalemated, it was a stalemate militarily, Assad still had, the government still had the upper hand. Number two, Assad knew the only thing that can turn the tide against his military offensive was a foreign intervention. Number three, Assad knew that the only thing that would trigger a foreign intervention was the use of chemical weapons, because Obama had already declared that to be the red line. Number four, a UN investigative team was already in Syria, had arrived a few days earlier to check out the claims about the use of chemical weapons. So Assad would have had to have been certifiably insane at that point to use chemical weapons. Many people don't like Assad for mostly good reasons, but so far as I know, certifiable insanity is not one of the things that has been ascribed to him. A murderer, yes. Ruthless, yes. Insane, no. So based on the factors I just enumerated, the likelihood that he used the chemical weapons, I would put at approaching zero. Then the question is, who did use them? My guess is that the so-called opposition is very well funded. It knew that the UN investigative team was now in Syria, and so either it managed to infiltrate the Assad army, or all you need is a little, you know, a medium amount of money, because all of Assad's generals, officers, they're murderers, thugs, corrupt, just like the Syrian regime. So if the Saudis hand over $5 million to some officer and say, all you have to do to get this money is just use some chemical weapons, fire them at this town, it's not... I don't think it's very difficult to pull off. Actually, I think it's pretty easy to pull off. So they got somebody to use the weapons. And just like in the build-up to the attack on Iraq, the biggest worry the United States had at the time, as you might recall, was the patient investigation by the UN team led by Hans Blix at the time. Hans Blix and also Mohammed El-Baradei. There were two different organizations investigating the issue of the weapons of mass destruction. And the main thing the U.S. wanted to do is preempt any unwelcome findings by the UN, the international investigative teams back in 2003. And that's what Kerry is doing now, because Kerry knows he's nobody's fool, and he knows that the UN is going to come back with two findings. One, they'll find that chemical weapons were used, but two, they'll also find that they can't definitively say who's responsible. That would be the inevitable result of the UN investigation. Well, not knowing who's responsible hardly provides a casus belli for the United States. So Kerry has to preempt the UN findings by declaring that we know that it was the Bashar regime that used the weapons. And so they're doing basically what they did in the build-up to the attack on Iraq.
Yeah, I'm pretty much on the same broad assumption as you are. I have a question from Rosie in Australia. She wants to know, Norman, if you see Israel as the only non-Islamic ally of the United States in the Middle East from Islamic extremism spreading, what do you think about Arab Muslims ruling so many countries in the world and historically invading?
I don't know what that question means. The question is almost as certifiably insane as some people think Bashar Assad is. First of all, the U.S. has lots of allies in the Middle East at the current moment. The Saudi regime is an ally of the U.S. The Jordanian regime is an ally of the U.S. The Gulf states are allies of the United States. The only outliers, what's called the resistance axis, consist of Iran, Syria, the current Syrian regime, and the Hezbollah. Otherwise, there's no resistance whatever to U.S. control over the Middle East. As to this talk about Arab-Muslim controlling countries, the Arab-Muslims control Arab-Muslim countries like Latin Americans control Latin American countries, and Europeans control European countries. I mean, what kind of insanity is that? I don't see any Saudis controlling, not that the U.S. would mind, but I don't see any Saudi republic in Latin America. I mean, what are these? This woman in Australia, I don't know, she's drinking too much kangaroo juice.
Okay, let's move on to another question. Mike in California wants to know if you see these wars in the Middle East turning into World War III.
No, not really. First of all, Obama knows what public opinion is like in the United States. Americans are war-weary. There's no public support for an attack on Iraq, so there's not going to be American soldiers. There'll be use of cruise missiles, maybe high-altitude bombing, making sure no Americans are captured, no Americans are killed. One of these cost-free, high-tech assaults, so Obama gets to claim that he took charge of the situation, kills several thousand Syrians, but nobody cares, and that will probably be it. Other powers who, as I said, there's a confluence of parties to the decision to attack Syria, but they don't all have the same agenda. There will be some people pushing Obama harder to do more in order not just to restore the initiative of the opposition, but also to bring down the Bashar regime. I doubt he's going to go that far. He'll be happy, as the Americans will, if you restore enough of a balance of terror that they'll continue killing each other until Syria as an entity is reduced to a nullity.
Yeah, I see it being a very, very bad picture. Switching to a different focus, Randy in Illinois wants to know what your analysis is on the attack of the USS Liberty in 1967. What is your knowledge of the false flag terrorism general throughout history?
Based on what I've read in the U.S. Liberty, I think it's clear. I think the evidence is overwhelming. It's not definitive, but the evidence is overwhelming that the U.S., that the Israelis attacked the Liberty knowing full well that it was an American ship. The American flag was on display. There couldn't be any real doubts in the minds of the Israelis that the ship they were attacking was an American vessel. As to why they did it, that's a matter of speculation. But the fact that they, with premeditation and consciously, assaulted an American ship and killed, I think it was 67 U.S. naval personnel. I don't think there's any serious doubt about that.
Okay, the second part of the question is, what do you think of a lot of the false flag terrorism that's going on throughout history?
I don't know what that means.
Okay. I'm guessing other false flag operations that might have happened, but...
I don't know what a false flag operation is. There was no false flag. There was an American flag. It was on the vessel. Israeli planes flew over the vessel. They flew over low enough for the lieutenant on the vessel to see the people, the Israeli pilots in the cockpit. They waved to each other. The American flag was in broad display. It was a clear day. So there was, I don't know what this has to do with a false flag. It was an American flag in full view on a clear day, clearly seen by the Israeli pilots, and they proceeded to attack the ship.
I believe he was asking about false flag operations that are happening everywhere else, not just the 1967.
I don't know what that refers to.
Okay. Basically, the terrorist activities like 9/11 and, you know, the conspiracy.
9/11, I don't know what false flag that what has to do with a false flag. There was an attack on the, there were several attacks on the United States on that day. I have no reason to believe that there was any conspiracy. I have every reason to believe that the basic picture that was presented about what happened is accurate. I have very little patience with conspiracy theories.
Okay, then let's move on to another question. Philip in Washington, D.C. wants to know, Norman, with growing displeasure from Jews toward their leaders' behaviors worldwide and the inner puppetry of the U.S. Congress, presidency, military, how can there ever be peace? With ambitions and powerful control are in the hands, shouldn't Jews ask their leaders to stop planting the seed of negative blowback onto Jews around the world in the future? And he said, I am Philip Zelik, Washington, D.C.
The Israel lobby plays a awful role in trying to influence U.S. policy, no question in my mind about that. And probably were it not for the Israel lobby, the U.S. would have forced Israel to withdraw from the occupied Palestinian territories. I have no doubt about that. And the way Israel and the Israel lobby carry on, they've certainly exacerbated the problems of anti-Semitism in the world. I have no doubt about that. So there's not much disagreement there. There are a lot of lobbies which do awful things. I think the gun lobby does awful things. I think the pharmaceutical and insurance companies do awful things. If you're a Cuban, I think the Cuba lobby does awful things. And Jews happen to be very rich, very well organized, and so they're able to do even more awful things.
Okay. Next question from our viewers is from Frank in Wisconsin. He wants to know what countries were behind the chemical attacks using white phosphorus and depleted uranium in the country of Iraq in the last decade?
Well, I think he knows the answer to that question. It's rhetorical. The U.S. used white phosphorus. The question of depleted uranium, it's still not been completely resolved. But there's certainly some evidence that depleted uranium was used in Iraq and also in Gaza during the Israeli attack in 2008-09.
Okay. And we have one more question from Gary in Illinois. He wants to know how WMDs are going to be secured and assured they will not fall into the hands of the militants.
Well, I think there are two issues. We should get rid of weapons of mass destruction for that reason. And number two, we should encourage the fragmentation of states so long as those weapons exist, because the likelihood of them getting into, so to speak, the wrong hands, and I have to put that in quotation marks because I think weapons of mass destruction in anyone's hands is the wrong hands, but certainly their complete, the promiscuous dissemination of them, it poses serious problems.
Well, okay, let's go back to my questioning to you. There are only two nations that produce sarin gas. And being a former military personnel, what I saw in the videos that were shown of the people that were somewhat alive and like the children that they were showing, it was inconducive to the medical reaction that somebody would have to sarin gas.
Some people have said that. I'm no expert on it. Doctors Without Borders have said it was a chemical weapon. I don't know if they said sarin in particular. I can't recall right now. There's a UN investigative team there right now. I think they will find that it was chemical weapons. That part, I think probably there's a high probability. But that doesn't answer the question of who used them, which is the second question, where almost certainly they're going to reach the conclusion that they can't tell. And that for the United States is obviously a disaster. That's why Kerry preempted the UN investigative team by saying it was the Bashar government, because he knows exactly what they're going to say. And if you come out with a conclusion, can't tell, how could that possibly justify an attack?
True. One other question for you on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Let's go back onto that one and retouch. The American media and the American... the news outlets are always highly on the side of Israel, and I've watched you on several occasions go toe-to-toe with them. Why is it that they try to not allow you to speak in full conclusion?
Well, I think the answer is obvious. The facts speak completely against Israeli policy, and say what you want about me and denigrate me as you like. My opponents are aware that I am fully cognizant of the facts, and therefore I'm not easy to be dismissed if I'm given an airing. And so the obvious tactic is to preempt me from having a hearing.
I've noticed that a lot, that whenever I'm arguing with a Zionist, it's always that they always try to discredit you before you even speak. They try to discredit you or bring down your demeanor or, you know, attack you in a vicious manner. Why is that so conducive of most Zionists?
Anybody, if they don't have control over the facts or they know the facts speak against them, are going to use various tactics to avoid discussing the issues. And one of the tactics people use is to engage in ad hominems in order to steer clear of the factual issues.
Correct. What do you see happening? You've answered that question. What do you see happening if the people don't go or coincide with what the Israelis are offering to the Palestinians? Of course, the current regime that is the Palestinian Authority and Mohammed Abbas, people are not too happy with Mohammed Abbas or the Palestinian Authority inside of Palestine due to their corrupt manners. Do you think that Israel will continue to help Assad remain in power?
I'm not sure why you leaped to Assad. Do you mean...
Abbas. I met Mohammed Abbas.
Yeah, the Israelis are happy with him. He does the dirty work for a not particularly high fee. He's a local collaborator, a hireling. So they, of course, prefer that he stays in power rather than for a vacuum to develop, in which case the Israeli army would have to start doing the dirty work again. And after the first intifada in 1987, beginning in 1987, they decide they don't want to do that work anymore and they'd rather Palestinians do it. So they found a gang of collaborators to do it for them, and they were quite successful. The Palestinian Authority is a very effective instrument now of U.S.-Israeli power.
Okay. What do you think about Hamas?
It's opportunistic. It carries on like the Muslim Brotherhood did, which is to say, even when it gets elected into office, it doesn't have a concept of trying to work for the whole society. It just works for its own organization. But that all being said, Hamas remains an indigenous movement, still remains rooted in the people. Whereas the Palestinian Authority is now simply an agent of the U.S. and Israel.
Very good. I have a caller on the line, Jaime from Austin, Texas, with a question for you, Norman. Jaime, go ahead.
Thanks, Rock. Mr. Finkelstein, how do you call yourself an honest researcher and you don't know what the hell...
Wait, I can't hear you because an ambulance is passing by. Go ahead, repeat yourself.
How can you call yourself an honest researcher? I found that very disingenuous that you don't know what a false flag is, and then you said it was in calling people conspiracy theorists over 9/11. That's an ad hominem attack. If you need some help finding out what a false flag is, you know, just there's lots of websites to find out.
Yeah, cyberspace is a very big. It's a very big.
We're talking about government websites. We're talking about political advocates, pundits on both sides have discussed this. I don't know if you've been a shut-in, but not knowing what a false flag in this day and age, that's shameful. You shouldn't be on the radio.
Oh. Sorry about that, Norman.
I humbly apologize.
All right.
Goodbye.
All right. We're going to have to end the show, Norman. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Hopefully we'll have you back again another time. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Okay, thank you.
Our guest for next week, Ellen Brown, the author of The Public Bank Solution, here on a People Speak Radio and a BBS radio network. This is Rock Cash signing out. Have a great week.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.